Hi, and welcome to the 367th episode of the MWA podcast. I'm Kyle Barton, and I'm here with Sean Wisniewski, Mark Hicks, and we're visiting this week with Kyle Kidwell, an outstanding custom furniture maker and chair maker located in Portland, Maine. So welcome to the show, Kyle.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. And so you're from the other Portland.
Yep. In the smaller, less known Portland. Yep.
Yeah, the Eastern Portland.
That's the only Portland I've been to.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. There you go. I can't say I've been to either.
Yeah, I haven't been to Portland, Oregon, so I guess that's interesting.
I've been to Acadia, Maine, and I've never touched Oregon. So,
there you go.
Closer than not. And a fellow, on the call that, it gets winter. And Mark, you probably get winter too, but Kyle, you don't get winter. So, at least you're four seasons up there in Portland, Maine.
I get pseudo winter. I get bouts.
Pseudo Missouri winter.
Yeah.
Come on. Last year we had 3.5 days of 20 degree weather.
Well, that's true.
And it shut the whole state down. And it leveled the state of Texas. Yeah.
Exactly. It did.
Yeah.
So, well, before we start talking about ice storms, hurricanes, and what Kyle's been up to, let's move into the woodworking news. So, first up, about a week and a half ago or so, Klaus, friend of the show, who's been doing a lot more blog posts for Lost Art Press, I had one on Swedish science, and it's about this this doctor that basically started looking and studying about the ergonomics of chairs. And it's a real interesting article, and it goes into, some of the facts, and he has a drawing here of, the most ergonomic chair and about all the angles and all of that kind of stuff. And it's pretty neat. And, for those aspiring chair makers out there, I highly recommend this article. In fact, he has some examples of some of the chairs that were mass produced with basically this formula in place in Sweden. So it's absolutely fantastic article. And it was published, I think, on September 9th. And again, that's on Lost Art Press blog, and it's Swedish Science by Klaus Strudlund.
Yeah. As a chair maker, Kyle, both of you. Yeah.
There's three of us on the call.
Okay, yeah. So Mark, you've done it too. Yeah. So the angle of that drawing, as I click on the link and scrolled up to it, the drop seat and then the back that's bends away from you, is that similar to what you guys have seen in other things? Like, that looks not comfortable to me.
Yeah. It's basically he's making sure that it hits the lumbar area. Yeah, there are a lot of seats.
It hits lumbar and lets the upper back just kind of be free to, if you want to lean back or not, but you have support at the lumbar.
The Velda's chair, and I think Galbert's rockers have something similar. And just about all the really comfortable chairs that we used to sell in our furniture store had shapes like that bent into the spindles in the back.
So in the 1900s knew what he was doing, huh?
I'm trying to figure out how far the seat drops. It's a 6-degree angle. It doesn't say that. I guess you just have to figure it out with your geometry. But
he's got it. It looks like the top of the seat's 400 millimeters off the ground.
Right. He doesn't have a measurement to the top of the seat at the back. So
you can do that with math.
You have to do the math.
Yeah. He's got.
That's why I got into chair making. I don't have to do math. This looks good.
Hypotenuse of the angle is, figure it out. It's in there. But you're interesting. Right. Yeah. I mean, that you saying that, the seat looks almost a little long or deep. I don't know how you'd say that. I have short legs. Is that 120 plus 80-ish?
Yep.
Is that 80?
Yeah,
there?
It's 17 inches to the plus to another the 20, 17 and 3/4-ish.
Yeah, that's about right.
18 inches. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a typical chair. And I say that because the drawing made it look more severe, but then the examples of the chairs down below, those absolutely look typical of that kind of chair. I'm sitting in a crappy, department store kitchen chair that has no bend in the back at all. It's a straight back, basically.
Yeah, and those chairs are very, very lightly saddled. So you could create that if you think about a saddled seat. So the side profile of the seat doesn't look all that severe, but then when you take into account a 3/4 inch deep saddling or 5/8,
all that too.
That's where you're getting that depth from. It's not just the top edge of the seat. It's where your butt is center of the chair.
And in that way, like you're never touching the meeting of the back and the seat with your body.
No, you don't touch that. That's like the spindle deck. You don't sit on the spindle deck.
Right. Oh yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
Yep. So
it looks comfortable to me. It would be a fun chair to make.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
You have a drawing.
The leg geometry could use some adjusting, but it looks kind of boring.
And the book you wrote might be interesting too. I'm sure you can find an English translation, maybe. I don't know. It was released in 1949, but
it's on everyone's shelf.
What was the name of that book?
It is Standing and Sitting Posture with Special Reference to the Construction of Chairs.
Okay.
As you do.
Well, it's a scientific paper.
If you're a
paper.
Descriptive writer, that is very descriptive.
Yeah. So we will. For those chair makers, it's definitely a great article. And like you said, it does have that thing that lays out all the dimensions and angles. So that's pretty cool. So check that out. And let's move on to one of our favorite companies has a couple of things out there, Woodpeckers. So they have a new one-time tool, which is a simple set fence gauge. So it's basically a gauge to ensure that your fence is parallel with your miter slot. And it's kind of interesting. And I think you can also use it to confirm that your saw blade is also parallel to your miter slot. And I thought it was kind of interesting and it kind of intrigued me. And it's only $120, which is interesting.
So I bought one. Say it. Go ahead.
No. If I didn't have other things, if I was brand new and I didn't have other things that I've already have that will accomplish the same task, I think one of those is actually from Woodpeckers. I would probably pick it up. It's $120. It's not too bad. And you can also use it to reference if you're always coming back to the same position on your fence because let's say you're doing some operations and you got to come back to your first operation. You can actually use these to record where your fence setting is so you can come back to that same setting. So, yeah.
Okay. That has an added thing. Who made the – there was a it was a setup gauge that – it was like a small barrel that set into the slot and then had a dial indicator pointed out to the side. And you could ride it up and down the slot. Who was that?
That was Woodpeckers.
It was Woodpeckers.
Woodpeckers.
Your blade,
saw gauge. And I actually bought one of those way back in the day.
But yeah, it's for the blade, but you can also do it for the fence, can't you? Mm-hmm. Like you could.
Yeah.
That's how you get your 3 thou runoff, so you don't get. Yeah.
Yeah.
So interesting that they're doing.
Yeah.
This is a little more robust and less technical.
It's a little less expensive than their saw gauge was. And and I like that you get two of these. Because basically you set one, say at the front of your saw, and then you move that to the rear of your saw and then set the next one up in the front. And so you can easily compare the two settings because you got two gauges right there. So, it's kind of interesting. And like I said, for what you're getting, I don't find it to be too outrageous of a price either.
No, if they added on some modular something that could also be an auto feeder for the saw, a pause of some sort to hold your work in the right place. you're already in those slots. Why not? That would be a key position to just like have an adjustable something, there that would hold your, I don't know. That's maybe making too much of it, but it is. I mean, you're right. I mean, for the price, it's not terrible. It's actually pretty good. It's one of those things though, like unless you're really critical, how often are you adjusting the fence on your saw? The first time you set it up, how often are you adjusting anything that would throw it out?
Probably,
or you need to check it?
probably at least once every 6 months for me, at least double check the thing.
Yeah. I mean, how often are you changing it? Checking it is one thing, I guess. But like, and this is a simple way, as long as.
Oh, how often? It all depends. But of course, you know, I tend to move my saw around more than most folks.
Right.
Especially during hurricane season when I have to totally get it out of the shop.
Oh, that's true. But, hey, when they're on wheels once a year, you got to evacuate shop.
But in fact, mine needs to be checked right now. I noticed I was cutting some a maple, which always burns, but then I cut some plywood and it was kind of burning too. Even with my plywood blade in there. No, that blade's pretty sharp. So I was like, ew, I need to check everything. I mean, it wasn't too bad, but it's just like, yep, I need to, as soon as I get some downtime, I need to get in there and check everything, make sure everything's still in alignment. I imagine something's off. Probably my fence, but who knows. But anyway, I thought it was kind of interesting. And, you know, like I said, not a bad price. And,
not bad.
Yeah. And speaking of not a bad price, Woodpeckers has introduced the Spin Right router motor. So basically, it's what's that old Porter cable?
690.
690?
No. The big beast one, the 3.5 one is seven something. I forgot. But everyone used to use that for the router, for their router tables. And basically, this is something like this, except it was designed for router table. And I think they said you can also use it in some of those small CNC machines, too.
Yep.
But, yeah, it has no fixtures or anything to be mounted into an actual router base.
It's just the body.
Yeah, it's just the body, and it's meant to be used in a router lift. And one of the things I found interesting is that it comes with these industrial collets. I mean, these are not like collets that have like, you know, four little clamping prongs, whatever you want to call those. These have like, you know, 10 or 12.
Yeah.
Or something like. Yeah. And they go from really big sizes all the way down to, you know, eighth of an inch size. So you can use a variety of different bits and whatnot. So, and it's just the router motor is $250. So that's right in the range of
In the range of those old ones, cables, if I remember it right. Yeah.
Yep.
Who is SpinRight?
I don't know. I kind of did a look and I couldn't find any reference to SpinRight other than them being available through Woodpecker. So I don't know if it's something exclusive with Woodpecker.
The trademark.
It's either their brand, their in-house brand, or they bought the company. And so,
that might be.
Mm-hmm.
But cool. I mean, that's not bad. It'd be, you know, if the Porter cable thing is not available anymore, because that was the old standby.
Will fit into the same. I would wager that it'll fit into all those plunge bases. And this is meant to just be a replacement motor for that router.
Yeah.
Now that it's not on the market.
Is that Porter cable one not available anymore?
Porter cable is done.
Yep.
What? I have that one.
Yeah, they are out of business.
Everybody had one of those. My dad has one for sure.
Yeah, they were bought out by somebody for a while, but their quality went way down. And I think you're right. I don't think they're in business at all anymore.
My tool supplier tells me that they are out of business. So.
Yeah.
Wow.
Somebody will buy them up and start it up again probably, but it won't be the same. So.
Yeah.
Man, I have that one currently, that 3.5 horse one in my router table. It's great, but I think it was like 2 years ago I bought it, maybe more.
Yep. Well, if it ever goes bad, here's a solution for you.
Take your measurements first. 4.2 inch diameter.
I meant to add, when I did do a search, I did find some other router motors that looked kind of similar. So this might be, you know, Woodpecker's, you know, putting a name onto a generic router motor that's widely available. I don't know that for a fact, but... you know, if you're in the market, you know, hey, look around and see what you can find.
Hmm.
But $250 for something like that, that's not bad. That's not bad at all.
Yeah.
And especially, if you're buying it from Woodpeckers, they're going to stand behind it. So, yeah.
Porter Cable still has a website. Still find their 3.25 horse router. When you say buy now, it takes you to Granger. And Granger says product is discontinued. Here's an alternate DeWalt. So, nope.
Wow.
And that DeWalt 3-horsepower plunger is $400. So, this is actually quite a good deal for just the body if that's all you need when you got a router table or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they also have some specials there where they you can get a router lift. I think one that fits her tables and one that fits other folks' tables. So not too bad. I think it's like $640 with the router and the lift, which
Which that would be the kicker if the existing lifts out there don't fit this body. That would
I think all lifts are going to fit this body.
I would hope.
Yeah, that's what the, I think that's one of the selling points of it. Yeah, is all the lifts will fit it. So yeah, but so if you're in the mood for a new router or you absolutely need one, check it out.
Yeah, infinite speed control from 10,000 to 22.
Yep.
1,000 RPM.
And it's got a soft start feature and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, not bad. It might be even a good upgrade for those Porter cables should they ever, you know, start losing their luster.
Yeah, you know, I do have a Woodpecker's router table, and I have one of those big, beefy Triton plunge routers that you can adjust from the top, and I put that in there. And I've always said, yeah, I really need to get a router, a proper router lift and stuff, but... to be honest with you, I just don't use my router table that much, and it works. So why mess with something that works at this point in time? Now, if I was using my router table every single day, I might change my opinion there. But, you know, when I'm like turn it on like once a month, it's fine.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a great horizontal surface for me to stack parts on. So. Well, with that said, there is a budding young woodworking community that just got started last week called the Joint Effort.
You don't say.
Yes. Somebody on this podcast might know a little bit more information than I do about that.
Well, I can answer questions. It's on this thing called the internet. And it's all about woodworking. The purpose is to hopefully build a community of people who are trying to learn and help each other build their hand tool skills. So it's not about cutting all your cords and going hand tools only. It's about, you know, incorporating hand tools into your woodworking practice and, you know, building skills and confidence. It's the same thing I've been trying to do with, you know, my Plate 11, YouTube channel and some of the stuff I've posted over the years on Instagram, but it just now there's actually a focus and there's a path and a goal, and hopefully, you know, it'll be useful. The initial push for this coming month for October is to start building a foundation of videos that it's all the things that I would have to teach my students when they show up and they're brand new to hand tools. So it's like, you know, how do you set it up? How do you inspect it? How do you sharpen it the first time? How do you resharpen it? What do you need? What do you really, really need to get started? That's what the first video is just the shortest list I could think of hand tools that you could use to just start cutting basic joinery if you're just kind of getting into hand tools, or to start using hand tools as a part of a power tool shop. And that video will be out when this airs. So.
Oh, fantastic. Wow. Well, nice. Yeah. And was that a snippet from the video you posted on Instagram where how many chisels do you need?
Yeah,
actually, just need one.
Don't buy a set. Yes. I think if anybody wants to take that video and set it to like an auto tune, you know, like video, you know, where they kind of loop it over and over again, I would be more than amused to allow them to do that. I don't have the skills to do that, but that was just I was editing video, and I did a take at night, and I went back and read my so I went through the whole thing and I went back and read my notes, and I was like, that is not what I had planned to do at all. It was rambling and it offered all these different options, and the whole idea of this video is look, if you know me and you trust me and you just want to know what to buy, this is it.
Yeah.
There are going to be more videos that go into the considerations behind each choice. But for now, just if you can find this stuff, buy it, because most of it is on back order and delay. But so I got up in the morning and reshot the whole thing. And it took about a third of the amount of time to shoot it. But I realized that I forgot to do the part about chisels, chisel and mallet. So I had to go back and search through the video from the previous night, and that rant was in there, and I was just cracking up. So decided that I figured some people on Instagram might get a kick out of it. So
yeah, it was pretty good. It was pretty good. I just disagree with you. I reach for my 1-inch chisel more than any others.
Really?
Well, yeah, but I do a lot of paring, so that's why.
Yes, that's my go-to. Like, I need to shave what's that little bit of a drawbore pin that's still sticking out.
Yeah.
The 1-inch chisel is the way to go. But I think for people, and I say in the video, like, if you have, maybe it's not in that video, but in the full length video, like, if you must buy more than one, get a 1/4 inch, get a 1-inch, and a 1/2 inch, you know, and those will take care of you for a very long time. But yeah, I do. I use that 1/2 inch chisel. I mean, I wore out a Lee Nielsen 1/2 inch chisel.
Wow.
It's not useless. Like, another woodworker who doesn't make workbenches could use it for another 5 years. But they start out a little bit shorter than the Lee Nielsen ones. And they get to a certain point where when I'm trying to pare down through 4 inches of workbench, the collar or what is that called? The cup? I don't know. It starts to push the chisel, the back of the chisel, away from the bench, and then I start gouging. So I don't get quite the life out of my chisels as most, you know, as most woodworkers do.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Yeah.
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 I personally, you know, you weren't there to guide me. You some 8, 10 years ago, when I did get the Narex set from Lee Valley of chisels, and I can attest to I only use 2 or 3 of them ever.
Did you go through all the pain and suffering of setting each one up, or did you just set them up as you needed them?
I did go through I'm gonna sharpen for an hour, and I went through all of them. I've only touched up the ones I use since then, though.
Like, did you polish all the backs or just sharpen?
Oh, I did. I totally did. I did. Sorry. Yeah. I went through all. That's fine. I don't care. I mean, my time's cheap, man. I mean, it's fine. And I know if should I need them, you know, that they're in good shape, you know, and they were there. That was a budget thing, you know, it's fine. You know, I got the mortising chisels too. And I used only the 1/4 inch mortise chisel.
Well, you might not have, I don't know when you bought them, but you might have only had the opportunity to buy them as a set. I don't know if they were selling them separately.
I don't know. It was pretty early when they brought them out, and they are metric too. So I don't technically have a 1/4 inch. I have a, what is that?
6 millimeter.
Some millimeter. Six, yeah. Seven, 6 or 8 millimeter. Yeah. And, so yeah, it's one of those things that argues, because I like to actually, in the one project I did, I had the Lee Nielsen tongue and groove plane, which is a true 1/4 inch. And so I, you know, routed that groove in, and then, or plowed that groove in, and then, you know, plowed in a tenon, a mortise through that, like for a mortise and tenon to go into that joint with where a panel was going to go as well. And I had to do a little finessing with a slightly smaller chisel because it wasn't the same width. Yeah, you know, it's whatever, metric. What can you do?
Well, I did laugh when
you mentioned chisels.
Yeah, I did laugh when you mentioned, you know, you really don't need that 1/8 inch chisel. And I go, yeah, I got an 1/8 inch and a 1/16 inch.
I think a 1/16 inch chisel. I said 1/32nd, and I realized that's a really small chisel. Maybe
and break in its first or second use.
Does anybody know how wide a fret wire is? How big that cut?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Oh, it's probably more than a 1/16.
It's a saw kerf width, like a handsaw kerf.
Yeah, yeah. They got special saws for that. Yeah. I think. I don't know. But anyway, so the joint effort. So if folks want to take a look at that, where should they go, Mark?
Go to jointeffort.net. If you're interested in the foundations videos, just click on there's like 3 invitations to join in. You have to quote unquote buy it. It's free. But in order to, it's just sort of an opt-in thing. And, there will be, you know, the videos will start coming out. I'm going to try to do a video 5 days a week through October. And then, they'll start to space out a bit as I start working on mini courses, which will be part of the next phase of the project. So, wow. And there's a blog. So there's a blog once each week, and I'm trying to treat that more like a newsletter. So I'm trying to, have some thoughts about woodworking, but also try to include some helpful things around, that I found over, the last 15 years of woodworking. So,
yeah, I noticed you had a special section for our podcast listeners too.
Wow. I did. Yes, I did. I was, what did I?
MWA listeners.
It's just, what's your advice or what was, yeah. I can't remember what I put on that page.
I think it was like a share your knowledge type stuff.
Yeah, just sort of what have you got to share? And so if you're not an MDO, if you're listening to this, you are a podcast listener. Listener.
Yeah.
Click on that link and do what it says and share some advice. Now, I one of the things I want to do this week or next on Instagram is try to find out from people, how and why they incorporated hand tools into their work and how that's helped them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there are a lot of people out there who may be considering it, and to hear from people who have done it would be helpful to them. So keep an eye out for that on Instagram, I guess the week after this show comes out.
All right. Fantastic. Well, speaking of podcast listeners, do we have a Patreon shout out?
We sure do.
All right.
This week, we're going to give a big thanks to our Patreon supporters, as we always do. Today is our special mention is Robert DeMarco. Robert, thank you for the follow and the Patreon support. If you would like to support us, the MWA podcast, that is, go to patreon.com/MWA podcast.
All righty. Well, let's move on to what's in the shop. So, Mark, what are you working on?
Well, before I came in to do this, I was working on cleaning up and prepping my old show bench for shipment down to Austin. I've got a customer down there who bought it. And I don't know if you've seen this bench at the Lee Nielsen shows, which is pretty much, I think maybe I had it at one of the WIAs. But
I was going to say, was that the one that we helped you move into North Carolina WIA?
Maybe. No, that was like one of the first split tops that I built for sale. Okay. No, this one is, so I built this one as a pair. The other one is in New Mexico and it's with Wida. She does a ton of carving. She follows after Fallen Speed, does a ton of carving, does sourdough stuff. She hasn't been posting much on Instagram lately, but, are you familiar with her?
I believe
so.
Okay. Yeah. I can't remember what her Instagram tag is. If I'd seen something more recently, I would know. But she ordered a bench, and we were talking about a all-walnut workbench. And I convinced her that, a maple top would probably be more usable. And so we did a bench that's walnut legs and maple top. And it has the houndstooth dovetails that Frank Straza made popular. And I built two at once. And so this is the twin to that one. And I took it out on the road for shows, and it was a great showpiece. People loved talking and looking at it. But I found that when I started teaching, this was not the bench that I was teaching. And it was difficult to say, well, yes, I can make this, but you can't make this in a class. There's not enough time. and I had one student try it, and it was tight, but we barely got it done. And they had actually quite a bit of experience with a handsaw. So, I decided after a few of those conversations, I need to switch up my show bench, and I need to find somebody to take this one home. And this customer in Austin was the one to do it. So
cool.
Yeah. There's some steaming and I had finish on it because it was going to be at a show and I was going to be eating lunch on it and that sort of thing. So, freshening up the finish and, getting it ready to pack up. So that should go out end of the week, early next week. So, and then I'm filming videos, lots and lots of videos, doing lots of editing. So,
yeah, you said you have 5 videos a day, right? That's a lot.
5 a week. So each day, 5 days a week.
Yeah.
A little more reasonable.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. So you're filming. I assume you're filming them all over a couple of days, and then.
Yeah, editing. I try to film them like a week's worth of videos in 2 afternoons.
Okay. Yeah.
And the thing that I'm really trying to do is answer one question in the video, because the thing that just really drives me nuts about a lot of woodworking videos out there is they go on and on and on. And, it's like, I just want the one question answered. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, like, how do I inspect a new hand, you know, this new block plane when it comes in? Cause that's the plane you should buy if you're going to get started. And so just a real quick, this is how you inspect it. That's it. You know, and then a separate video for how do I set it up? Because mm-hmm. you're going to have to stop and go do the stuff. I'm not doing this. I mean, by all means be entertained, but I'm not doing this for entertainment purposes. I want you to watch the video, rewind the video, go out and do the thing in the video, and then come back and watch the next one. So, and these will all, these foundations videos will all slowly trickle out mm-hmm. to YouTube, but, I really want people to watch them on my platform because there are no ads. There's no YouTube rabbit hole, you know, so the only reason for me to put them on YouTube is to help people find me, find the website, join the website and watch the videos on the site. I hate watching ads in the middle of a video. So, mm-hmm. but if you want to stay on YouTube, that's fine. They'll be out there. You just have to wait. It's going to take a lot longer for them to all get out on YouTube than it will to get them all onto my site. So. Mm-hmm. There's your motivation.
Good. So, are you going to do any TikTok or Reels?
Wow. Geez.
I may do some Reels. You know, okay. I have some ideas for very short videos, but
I don't watch all of them. But
they will not be a musical.
They won't. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't dance. Like I said, if somebody wants to, you know, what's change the pitch of their voice and
auto-tune.
Somebody wants to make an auto-tune reel for me. I'll be happily to put it on my feed and give you credit for it. Just, you know, go out and have fun with that chisel rant, but I don't have time for that. So.
Alrighty. Well, Sean, what are you working on?
So I'm recovering from a weird injury. For the avid listeners who may have noticed my absence 2 episodes ago, mm-hmm. I was totally fine up until I went to bed on a Saturday night, and I had searing pain in my lower back and my hip, and I spent the following day largely prone on my back, got muscle relaxers, got ibuprofen flowing. And I'm still not right. There's something, I think I had nerve damage, and I think in some way I did actual strain damage to the muscles in my right leg. It's really weird. I went to urgent care. I went through a prednisone like.
Oh, that's course. A good shot.
Yeah. No, it was pills, no shots.
Oh, I was thinking about the painkiller shot that they put in your back when you.
No, none of that. None of that. But this was, I mean, I said, I've run marathons. I know what fatigue feels like. Only my right leg feels like it's run a marathon. I have strains in my, like sections of my quads in my right leg that are tight. Mm-hmm. And they've been tight for 3 weeks now.
And it's not like sciatic.
It started as sciatic, but I have no lower back pain anymore.
Huh.
It's now all my legs below my knee. I've got swelling in the soleus muscle, which is that muscle on your shin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how, but I must have strained it somehow. So I'm going through like daily tens unit ice, heat, elevation, you know, everything, just trying to get it to repair itself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of crazy. Anyway, so I've been kind of like limping.
Physical therapy, orthopedist?
I haven't. No. I haven't. No? And I mean, I... Google's fantastic, and my wife's a nurse practitioner. Uh-huh. I know exercises and stretches that I can do, and I go through pretty much a course daily of those kind of things. I'm not to that point to see like a specialist at this point. I'm kind of resistant to that kind of thing for no good reason. I'll admit
that. Or even just like, did they do an x-ray at the urgent care?
No, they didn't. It would more be like an MRI.
Yeah,
I
that's what wonder I was about to say. You need an MRI, something. Probably. Yeah.
Like soft tissue.
Yeah, exactly. And it felt at times that it was soft tissue. And so I'm dealing with that. And like, I have a buddy at work who's like, here, you know, you just need to roll it. You need to do this. I'm like, it really kind of feels like maybe damage, not just sore. You know, like it has that feeling. So we'll see. It kills me because you guys know, I'm an avid runner. You know, yeah. I'm thankful that this occurred. I mean, I was running with my friends. We're training for their marathons. I ran 20 miles a week before this happened, for fun, but whatever. But for that, for me in that like mindset to not now be able to run is kind of damning. It really sucks. So working through that. As I sit here, I've got a tens unit on my quads. just giving it a little massage.
We wish you the best, but yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's just weird.
Need to go see that specialist, you know.
Yeah, I know. As I told my wife, I said, this too will pass. You know, it's not going to end me. I know that. It's just, you know, we'll see. I mean, I can run upstairs at this point. It just still feels weird.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of crazy. Actually, I ran a mile tonight and it's okay. But it just, the recovery is not what I used to be able to do. I know that sounds stupid, but like I'm used to running 6, 7, 10 miles a day. Like,
yes, but not one, with one damage. Mentioned the word damage multiple times. Yeah, like maybe get the damage checked first before you damage it some more.
I've never claimed to be smart. Anyway, in other non-related to woodworking things, my bees. So I got bees. We've got hives. We found recently one of our hives didn't have a queen. Couldn't find their queen.
Oh yeah. I remember you mentioned.
Oh no. So we already went through this once.
Oh, this is
other
a new one.
We found what are called supersedure cells. They're making a new queen. Okay. Why are they making a new queen? We can't find a queen. Okay. We can't find any laid eggs, so no one's producing new bees in here. Well, that's weird. And so last week we took the kind of blunt move of destroying those queen cells where they were making new queens and combined that hive with another hive. Put them right on top.
One hive?
No, two. We had three at once. Because we split the previous swarm attempt, we split into two. So we had three at one point. We're now into two, but two, that second one is super tall because it is a hive on top of a hive. And the way you kind of introduce them is to, well, there's a bunch of ways, but so because bees can be kind of territorial, the kind of go-to is to put a couple layers of newspaper between them and let them slowly eat a hole and get their pheromones mixing so that they don't totally hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been now 3 days. We're noticing that they're using the upper entrance less than the lower entrance. So we think they might be combined, but we're going to give them to the weekend and see, but I, you know, for a second year beekeeper, I think we've experienced 75% of the possible issues with bees this year. And we're learning a ton as we go, and it's great, but it's really kind of alarming at times, you know. And it is like we do these inspections, we're looking for mites, we're looking for healthy, you know, brood rearing, all this other stuff, just to see. And to be clear, we're not honey producers, we are just beekeepers, we're trying to keep bees. And we noticed this one is like they're storing a bunch of nectar, they're making honey, but there's no new babies, and these things don't live but a month.
Mm-hmm.
So you go, well, this isn't going to work. You know, now they're trying to make a new queen, but they're making a new queen in autumn in Northwest Ohio. There's a low chance of this surviving the winter the way they're doing it right now. So we're giving them their best chance, we think, by combining them with another hive to let that population work together with one good queen. And hopefully that all goes well. But we'll see. Maybe that'll be chaos when we check it this weekend. But
a pile of dead bees around the hive?
No.
Because they'll kill each other and throw the dead bodies out, right?
Oh, yeah. It's hilarious. Actually, we saw them take down a yellow jacket wasp the other day. It's really cool. Like, you see in very small form, it is a knockdown, drag out WWE brawl. And you'll see two bumping against one. And I literally have seen one go over the foe and flip it backwards over its body. It was really funny, but suplex. They do. They, I mean, yeah, suplex kind of. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, they really, yeah, it is. And that's the way that we're in, why we read up on it before we did it, but we're like introducing them kind of softly to kind of try to help that. And that's what actually my wife noticed today was we have this small upper entrance and then the lower doorway, which is still reduced, but it's a little bit bigger. And there are fewer going up where the moved hive is and the original hive in that location, their doorway hasn't changed. And so we're thinking they're mixing a little bit. Nothing's restricting anyone from going out a door and going in another door, but the major move would be internal. And so we're giving them, you know, more time before we actually crawl in there and look, but we're thinking hopefully they'll combine. I mean, that's our goal. We're not trying to kill anybody. We did have, yeah. So I don't know if I talked about it. We had a swarm. One of our hives took off and half of them left. That's actually the one that was making into queen.
Okay. So they went ahead and swarmed, huh?
Well, they did unexpectedly. It's really kind of strange because we check every week and we didn't see it. So that's really quick for that to happen. So like somebody left without even preparing for that to happen, which is really strange. But and there's different type of queen cells that I won't get into the detail, but we saw that hive, we tracked it, and it was 30, 40 feet up in a tree in my neighbor's yard. We could see it through binoculars. And it stayed there, that swarm stuck to a tree through 40 degree nights, through a rainstorm, and for I think 8 days, more than a week, and they were still there. And then one day, gone. We don't know where he went. Just amazing. But, I mean, we know, you know, bees left alone will survive. You know, they'll do their thing. They'll find a hole. They'll make a nest. They'll do, you know, whatever. But it's been a year. It's been a strange year for them. But that's what I'm dealing with. Kyle, you got a little more woodworking-related things going on?
Well, yes. I'm working on jigs. That's all I do anymore is work on jigs.
That's all I do.
I guess. Especially right now, I'm a little behind. We did have some issues with the family. My father-in-law passed away last week, but it was kind of expected.
Is your wife out of town again then?
No, she's going out of town probably in the next couple of weeks. They already had this funeral service, but she'll be there for the interment, you know, and all that stuff. So, so we got that. I mean, like I said, it was expected, but you know, when those things happen, it's, you know, it's sad. And anyway, so I got a little behind, so I apologize to anybody out there waiting on orders. I'll catch up as quickly as I can.
How dare you, Kyle?
I know. But I was able to get out before this all happened. I was able to get out a video on my boring jig in use with the reamer. So the new reamer that my buddy Sean Murphy is selling, the 6-degree reamer. So so we got that, and I got that video shot. It's, I don't know if it answers any questions, Mark, but it is long and boring. So
I think it was great. I watched the whole thing. I showed my wife. I said, look at this. Look what Kyle's doing. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
But anyway, yeah. So I reamed some holes in a pine blank I had sitting around, and also reamed a couple of holes in some, what I want to say, poplar blanks that I had. And that went extremely well. It took me a little off-camera testing, of course, to get the feed rate right for a little bit harder wood, the pine, which surprisingly is just a little bit faster. I mean, we're not going real fast here. We're on the number one setting of your drill, but going fast. But what I found extremely pleasing and mind-blowing is even, you know, using the boring jig to ream these holes, even if I ran into a problem where the reamer grabbed and everything stopped and, you know, it was, you know, starting and stopping and stuff like that when I was trying to get the feed rate right. Even with all of that, you know, kind of herky-jerky reaming, that when everything was done, everything came out perfect. The hole was nice. It was at the exact angle that you were reaming at. So, I mean, everything, even, you know, if you have a little hiccup here or there with the actual reaming action, it's not, you know, throwing anything off or anything like that. It's, you know, you just got to get your feed rate right. And so I found that extremely pleasing that, you know, hey, that happens. You don't have to be, you know, a first timer can do it. And even if they, you know, go too fast or too slow, you know, once they get everything right, they're not going to screw up their angle or anything of that nature. So,
cool.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. So, you know, if you're interested in that, check out that video. It's on my IGTV as well as my YouTube. And yeah, pay my buddy Sean Murphy at Sean Murphy Windsor Chairs. .com a visit, and you can pick up one of these reamers. They are extremely, extremely, extremely nice.
Yeah, I mean, I know you
yeah.
may be less than confident, but I think your demonstration in your video was fantastic.
Yeah,
it showed that it is really cool. The combination of your guide and that tool, I think, and having never done it myself, mm-hmm. But I understand the struggle that Windsor chair making is, and you good work. Well done, you and Sean, on making that happen. That's slick too, and repeatable, which I'm guessing is very important to be.
Yeah,
you make a quip on there that's like, it's chair making. What's a half degree? Yeah. But you know, it's less than that, and it's pretty darn precise. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is very, very precise, and that's what I love about it too. Is it's easy, no lasers, no bevel gauges. You just point and shoot basically, and it's fantastic. So highly recommend the reamer, and it works, like I said, it works perfectly. You know, and if you're somebody that uses the Lee Valley reamer, it will also work. You know, I just prefer the 6 degree angle, and Sean's reamer is a little nice and runs a little bit truer with less chatter than the Lee Valley reamer does, because it only has
Lee Valley's is a 12
degree. Yeah, it's a 12 degrees, and it's got two cutters on it. Sean's only has one cutter on it, so it kind of runs a little bit smoother with less chatter than the Lee Valley one does, at least in my experience.
You're taking less material too, which means less work, less time.
While
we're singing Kyle's praises, I want to say that you did a really good job on the Texas Woodworking Festival episode.
Oh, thank you.
If you all haven't had a chance to go back and listen to that one, there's a couple nice interviews in there. Well, more than a couple, but thanks for doing that.
Oh, not a problem. It was challenging to put together, just because trying to clip all those together without me saying, "Hi, this is Kyle and I'm back." Well, you don't need to hear me say that 12 times. "Hi, this is Kyle and I'm
it's
back.
It's still Kyle."
Uh-huh. And so, a teaching moment for you, that say that next time you're on a live recording, you don't have to introduce yourself every time you record.
Exactly. But putting that all together. But it was fun. It was fun. Yeah, we had a good time, and go and listen to it. There are some.
I still need to, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, good. So with that said, speaking of Kyle, so Kyle, what are you working on in the shop?
Yeah, I am currently working on a batch of 6 side chairs out of cherry, and that's going to match up with a dining table. So it's a dining set. And it's actually an old client from a few years ago, where he already has 2 armchairs and 2 side chairs. And he reached back out and basically said, "I want a much bigger table with 6 more chairs." So,
That's nice.
Kind of circling back to stuff I did for him. And he gave me the green light. It's really, really awesome. He gave me the green light to basically do a new design, where he's going to get the first one. It's pretty well sorted out as far as like how to do it. It's just scaled up from a desk that I do, but I'm excited to get into that. So I'll finish these chairs and start milling some more cherry for this table.
Yeah, I think you posted some photos over the last couple of days on that. So yeah, it's looking really great.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so a lot of times there's more than one or two things going on in the shop. It kind of just depends on the week or the month. So there's a guy who's been working with me in the shop. I have an employee who's 4 days a week, and he actually broke his thumb like a month ago. It wasn't in the shop. I feel like that would be everyone's first instinct. That would be
That's going to be my follow up question.
Yeah. It was elsewhere. It was outside the shop. But so he kind of is in limbo where he was in a cast and he just got his cast taken off and found out today he's got another 4 weeks to go and maybe more after that. So I'm kind of changing the way I'm usually when there's two of us in there, there's, you know, 3, 4, sometimes 5 things going on. And so it's just me in there. And I've done that. I've done years of that before. But I'm just not doing as much at the same time. So, you know, 6 chairs is plenty for me. Just working solo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, cool. Yeah. I actually had a shop incident when I was filming my video. I forgot to talk about. So I had this leg blank on the edge of my bench, and I had it clamped kind of way out on the bench. And I went and did a couple other things. A couple hours go back, I go to unclamp it, and I forgot it was so cantilevered over. The thing fell right on my toe.
Oh.
Yes, the poplar chair blanket. And it's like, luckily everything's okay. But when you talked about busting your thumb, I go, yeah, I busted my big toe.
I mean, I think if I had to choose, I'd definitely choose my toe over.
Yeah. I was screaming and cursing there for a while, but luckily nothing broken or anything like that. But yeah, I am good. In the market for some steel-toed boots now, so we'll see.
Yeah.
But so tell us, so how did you decide to become a professional woodworker?
I mean, that's kind of a, I'm not sure how to answer that directly in like a clear.
Because I read your bio on your website and said you have a degree in poli sci, I believe.
Yes. Yep. Correct.
Yes. So that seems, you know, like the undergraduate degree you want to become a professional woodworker.
Yeah. Any young aspiring woodworkers, you should major in political science and become exceedingly jaded about American politics and get into woodworking. I got my degree in that. And by the time I graduated, I knew that I wasn't going to do anything with it. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe doesn't sound good, but at the time it felt good to be aware of that. I was not on that path. And so, what happened from there right out of school is I got into carpentry. A friend of mine who also, we went to the same college, this is in Virginia. So I'm actually originally from Virginia. He started a carpentry business and asked me to partner with him. And I was, at the time I was 22, and I was just kind of like, it just seemed intuitive to me to go for it. You know, I didn't really have a better option, and I was really enjoying carpentry at the time. And that's kind of how I started really getting into tools and being on job sites and doing that sort of work, you know, finished carpentry, trim carpentry, framing, you know, mm-hmm. all the whole range. And so as I was getting some of those machines, you know, they're not really machines. I think in that vein, I kind of refer to them more as tools, you know, like a contractor table saw, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I had all that stuff in my shop, and I just started making, you know, crappy furniture that at the time felt so exciting to me, you know, to just have an idea and have the tools that were available to me and do the best I could. And so, you know, the carpentry was definitely a precursor to furniture, because I, in my mind, when I kind of look back on getting from there to today, I've always been making furniture. It's just been at different levels of, you know, different frequencies. Like maybe I'd make one piece a month for a while, and then I'd go larger chunks without making stuff, but
mm-hmm.
it's always been there. Yeah, so if you saw the bio on my website, I went to New York from Virginia, and that was another turn. That was for me. I was trying to do music at the time, so you know, that obviously is pretty far off from furniture, but
you'd be surprised how many furniture people are ex-musicians or musicians on the side or whatnot. So
I mean I was just gonna say I would argue that there's, in my mind, there's a lot of overlap between music stuff and making furniture,
that creative outlet kind of thing. So what kind of music did you play or do you play?
Well, I don't really play anymore, but I still kind of tinker around. My kids have a beater guitar in the common space, and I'll pick it up. So I was mainly doing guitar, and in the New York days, I guess I would describe it as like experimental pop, where, I want all music, at least for me personally, I like it to be listenable on some level. I don't want it to be so far out there that, you know, I can't really digest it. So I was doing a couple of bands and different projects, just like playing bars and really small venues. It was very humble. Like, I never got particularly far with it, but, you know, it was really important time just for trying to figure out what I was into and what was making sense for me. And, when I moved to New York, I felt like if I didn't try to do music, I would really regret it later. So that was like 2007. So I was there for 7 years, which is, you know, it's a good chunk of time. And I was still doing like carpentry, woodworking stuff for my job, for my vocation, my paycheck, and still making furniture, still doing carpentry. Like, I would go home to Virginia for like a break or something, like see friends and family on a holiday. And inevitably I would get into these projects, like at my mom's house or something. So still doing projects, still getting tools and, making furniture still. And then I ended up working at the Guggenheim Museum. That was my like defining job.
Cool.
York. Yep. So that was just kind of a fluke. You know, what preceded that was I worked at a frame shop, like a high-end art frame shop, where we would do, you know, stuff for galleries and museums and collectors. And it was really eye-opening just seeing all that. I didn't know anything about it before I got there, you know, just that world of art and collectors and the museum world is all like really brand new to me. I was super green when I started seeing it for the first time. So being at the frame shop, I, you know, befriended some people who had ties to the Guggenheim, and then that led to, hey, there's some work at the Guggenheim, are you interested? And I was like, yeah. And then all of a sudden I was working there. I was installing shows where every time they have an exhibit, they need a crew to take down the current show and then put up the new one. You know, they're basically art handlers or art installers. And so working in that department, you kind of see the way the museum is structured. And so there's all these different departments in the museum. And I kept seeing the work being done by what's called the fabrication department at the Guggenheim. And it was just kind of blowing my mind. They were doing crazy casework and compound angles. And it was just like wild stuff. And it was always changing from one exhibit to the next. And so I basically just kept, talking to the department head of fabrication and basically saying, like, I really want to work in the shop. And he let me in the shop, and I started working in the fabrication shop, and that was super instrumental. That's why my business is called Kidwell Fabrications, because
I was just about to ask that.
I mean, you know, it's complicated. Like, I have mixed feelings about my time there, because there are a lot of difficult personalities, and there's a lot of aspiring artists there, and I viewed myself as a musician, so I didn't really consider myself to be in that group. But the people I worked with in that shop were everyone, I think, who has enough time under their belts has been in a shop where like there's just difficult personalities. And so I was kind of navigating all that and still inspired by what those people could do. You know, they just were so confident in so many ways. And it changed my idea of what fabrication means. You know, I always felt like it meant metalworking and welders and, stuff like that. Nothing to do with wood at all. And then from being in there, I just started to view it as like, oh, it's more of a general term. You know, it's just you have a concept or something you're trying to make, and you know, what does it take to get from here to there? And it definitely influenced me, you know, just thinking about what it takes to execute a vision. And so, yeah, in New York, I met my wife in New York too. So that's kind of, we're getting all over the place. Like, how do I get into
We're getting there.
We're getting there eventually. But so I met my wife in New York and we got engaged and then we got married, and we were married in New York for a year. And at that point, I was starting to feel like super stir crazy. Like, I knew at that point I wanted to make furniture. I had been making stuff consistently, like off hours, moonlighting, you know, both at the old frame shop where I used to work, or just wherever I could get shop time. And so I could see from being in New York that to have like a legit shop space, I basically determined that it was unattainable, you know, like to... There's a lot of co-ops in New York and, you know, shared spaces, which didn't appeal to me. So I basically told my wife, Lauren, I was like, we got to get out of New York. She was prepared to stay because she's a textiles designer, and that whole industry is like very much centered in New York. And I was just kind of like, I feel like we got to get out of here. And we wanted to have children and own a house and do all that kind of stuff. And increasingly, I just couldn't picture it in New York. And she agreed too, but I think I had more urgency than she did. So then it became a question of like, all right, where are we going to go from New York? And that's how, you know, we get to Maine. So I looked for work basically as a cabinet maker or a carpenter. I started out looking in Virginia and, you know, because that's my home state. And the pay just wasn't very appealing, you know, if you were kind of going backwards from New York. And so Lauren, my wife, got a job offer in Kennebunk, Maine at a satellite studio. I'm thinking here, Sean, you're in Michigan, right?
No, Northwest Ohio, really close to Michigan.
Okay. Somehow I got that in Michigan. So her her headquarters is in Michigan, but her boss is from Maine. And so her boss... Basically, as a stipulation for being the design director for this textiles company, she was like, I'll take the position, but you have to let me work in my hometown or in Kennebunk. And so she kind of negotiated for the satellite studio in Maine and then offered Lauren a job to be a textiles designer there. And I had never even been to Maine. You know, I was... I felt like Maine was just so off the radar. I didn't even have a negative view of it. It was just, I was just indifferent to Maine, kind of like, how many, are there even a million people in Maine? I just had no real.
It's a pretty big state, but it's not the most populous by any stretch.
Yeah, that's right. It is. It's super, it's a huge state. You know, the longer I live here, I'm like, oh my God, man, there's so many areas and pockets and there's a ton of islands and, there's a lot left for me to learn about it. But, yeah, there's like basically a million people. So I just kind of agreed to check it out because she agreed to come to Virginia to check out Virginia. So it's just on Earth now, my turn. And I pretty much from the jump was like, I can't move to Kennebunk. It's too quiet. We're going from like Brooklyn to Kennebunk. I just can't picture it. And so I basically said I would consider Portland. So that's what we did. We moved to Portland. We skipped renting. We just immediately bought a house, which a lot of they thought we were crazy, and maybe we were, but it worked out great for us. We still live in the same house, and my shop is a detached. I have a, I guess you could call it like a 4-car garage. It's a 1,000 square feet. It's a good size for me.
Oh, that's nice. I would have bought right away if I found something like that.
I know. The shop didn't exist. You know, that was built like 4 years after we moved here.
Okay.
So my first shop was in the basement, which again was super humble. But, you know, that all just goes back to, I just had this yearning of like, I just need a space. You know, I need a space to try to manifest ideas and just put the time in, you know, get time in on machines and making mistakes and just kind of making progress. You know, I'm definitely a believer that progress can only occur when you put time in the shop. And so that's when things really started to kind of come together for me, where I had space, raw space, and not really any real machines to speak of, but I knew that's what I was working toward. And I just kept moonlighting. I took a job as a cabinet maker for a brief spell in Brunswick, which is like half hour north of Portland, and then took a position as basically, I guess they call it a furniture maker. This place called Houston and Company, which is right outside Kennebunkport. And so while I was there, I was constantly moonlighting, or, you know, side hustle, and all the money I made, I would just buy machines, buy stuff for the shop. That's kind of like the super long answer to, I had this idea of, I knew I wanted to make furniture, and in particular furniture, you know, because I feel like, I don't know how much you guys can relate to this, but when you kind of start dipping your toes in, there's a lot of people that want cabinetry. And I feel like that's a whole different trajectory. And I've definitely grazed up against cabinetry and made concerted efforts to like not do cabinetry. So, you know, I knew that's what I was working toward, is freestanding furniture, you know, hopefully solid wood furniture, and, you know, just trying to put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah. Well, that totally makes sense. Well, one of the things, you know, I'm interested about is where your, I guess, for lack of a better term, your design philosophy came about, because a lot of your pieces are fairly contemporary. I wonder how much of that museum influence is there, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've definitely given some time to consider like where anyone's design influence comes from. Obviously, when I think about, for me, I used to be drawn to, I was into like mission style stuff early on, like in my college days, and like two-tone woods. And I thought that was amazing at the time. And when I think back on that now, I'm like, man, it's so tacky. Like, I can't believe I ever thought that was any good. And I definitely think that as more time elapses between being in Maine and being in New York, I feel like New York definitely had its role, you know, like the museum world definitely has, I guess it's subjective, but the parts that I saw, or the parts that resonated with me, were pretty minimal, very simple stuff. And
Because there's, I mean,
Guggenheim is modern art, right? I mean, it's
because there's definitely some, I can see some like mid-century modern type influences in some of your work, but it's not that either. It's a take on that, but it's not, you know. So I guess what I'm trying to say is your furniture has a unique look, and it's fantastic. I really appreciate that.
That's awesome, man. Thank you. Yeah. I feel like that's been one of my pursuits, is to just find my own voice. Because once I kind of delved into Danish furniture and Scandinavian furniture, mid-century furniture, I knew I really liked it. I liked how lean it all is, and it tends to be more simple. Mm-hmm. And that really speaks to me, just kind of keeping things simple. It's a really cliche concept, but it just resonates quite a bit.
But simple is hard.
It is.
Yeah. So that's, all that's true. You know, simple is hard, and, you know, trying to find your own way of expressing yourself can be challenging. And so anyway, I appreciate that it's coming off as, it's got some of my own interpretations on things. You know, it's not quite Scandinavian, at least that's what I hope it's not, and it's not quite Japanese or Shaker. It's somewhere in between all those things, hopefully.
And like you said, it all speaks with one voice, which is fantastic for anybody that's making furniture, is, you know, having that voice and saying, that's definitely a Kidwell piece there.
That's awesome.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
That's the goal. That's what I'm trying to work toward for sure.
So what's been your favorite project that you've made so far?
So I don't know if I could. I think I was kind of considering that earlier today. I kind of look back. I had this one client early on who asked me for a table, and I made her the table. And then I kind of did one of those, I don't know if the word is knee jerk, but you know, you kind of have this instinct to say or do something and you're not sure if you should, but you just say it anyway. So I said, I said, do you want chairs to match the table? And she was just like, that would be great. And, you know, she said that, I was just like,
oops.
Oh shit. Now I got to make a chair. At that point, I'd never made a chair, and I was way out of my depth. And so I just forced the issue. You know, that's kind of like a theme with me, you know, professionally, career wise, is I just have a tendency to commit myself to something that I'm not totally sure I can do it, but I think I probably can, and just kind of pushing my comfort level all the mm-hmm. time. And so when I look back on that, that was 5 years ago. You know, I had zero chairs under my belt, and I just kind of trudged through it. It wasn't, yeah. I don't even know if I would describe it as enjoyable. I mean, parts of it were, I was just reaching the whole time, you know? But now when I reflect on it, I view it as, it was very pivotal, you know, it kind of, gave me the confidence to, you know, keep going. And, I view it as a success at the time. So yeah, I feel like that one was very impactful for me, just doing the first set of chairs and, mm-hmm. trying to figure it all out. And, you know, it's really, if you saw a picture of it, they're not like super sophisticated at all. They're very simple chairs. They have, you know, kind of squared off sides and stuff. And they're not like, super wow. But for me, it was a big reach.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for anybody just starting into something like chairs, I usually dread it for a few years, but yeah, you didn't have a choice. You said, hey, I got to get this done. And let's get started.
Yep. So there you have it.
I think it's kind of a cool East Coast thing. I had a buddy that went to school out in Massachusetts and then worked at a restorer's place for a while. He now, I think, works for Woodcraft, but he, you know, doing time like you did in the Guggenheim and then kind of branching out on your own gives you that kind of unique eye to like have a lot of reference, more than I've ever seen, you know, as far as what's out there already, and then, you know, making it your own going forward. I mean, you're going to take some leaps. It's going to happen, but it is your own choice as you go, which is really, really kind of cool to see. And you're by looking at what you've made, I mean, doing a good job of it.
Oh yeah. Thank you, man. I appreciate that. Well, so I made those chairs. I did not make the table. Yeah.
And you can barely see the table. So the chairs are prominent. That's
So those chairs are, that's the chair that I made for that client when I was like, hey, do you want matching chairs? That was, that's the first.
So that's like your first chair project. Holy crap.
Yeah. I was, you know,
like eight of them.
yeah, it was, you know, and actually at the time I just did side chairs. I didn't have armchair version. So again, like that's just another example where, you know, basically what I did to try to get traction for my own business was to develop relationships with interior designers. That's been in a lot of ways my business model. It's kind of shifting more recently where I'm getting like legit orders on Instagram, which I never would have guessed going into it. But so, you know, I really pushed getting to know New England based designers, Maine based designers. And pretty early on, they would say, oh, we love the Rosemont side chair. Do you make an armchair? And I just said yes, even though I didn't know what I was going to do. And I think when I look at this picture, I'm pretty sure that those were armchairs number 3 and 4. Made 1 and 2 not too long before that. Just from demand, you know, someone says, can you give me chairs for the heads of the table? And that's just kind of, I've just conditioned myself to whenever possible, just say yes and figure it out later.
Well, that's cool. And I love the exposed joinery on that. What are you using to make that joinery though? Like, multi-router or JDS type thing or a panel router or something, or just a router?
Jiggle?
No, actually, it's none of those things. So those, I don't know how well you can pick up on it from the pictures, but there's like a 3-degree flare, or it's like angled by 3 degrees from the front to the back. So the front rails and the back rail are angled at 3 degrees.
Okay.
So it kind of makes the those exposed tendons kind of tricky because they're like on a 3-degree slant, you know.
Okay. And yeah.
What I do is I clamp. It's pretty cowboy, I guess, when I think about it. But I clamp the chairs dry, and I have all these locations and marks and stuff to set heights and the inset and all that stuff. And I clamp them dry where it's just like a tension fit, and I put a 1/4-inch spacer on the rails, which is the offset or the inset of the rails. And go all the way through the leg and the rail with the domino, with the joiner, the domino XL.
Okay.
And then come back later with floating tendons, you know, whatever the chair is, if it's oak or cherry. So those are all floating tendons. And particularly on the backrest, there's very little material to work with there. You know, it's on like a compound angle. And when I was going through it, I was kind of like, man, how am I going to get tendons on this little dainty of the backrest. And so, yes, his clamps holding it while it's dry and gets the mortises in there. And then when I do the glue up, it's the solid wood floating tendons.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting technique there. Yeah, I almost said domino, but those look way too big. I just had the Domino 500, so
yeah. You don't have the XL.
Oh, I don't have the XL, and so that's what it makes, you know, in my mind. Hey, it doesn't look like a domino. It looks like something a little bit beefier, but hey, it is a little bit beefier.
It is a beefier domino.
Well, they only do even the XL. I think just on like one tick mark location. I think it's like 1 1/8 inches or something for a width, and so I actually will like enlarge the slot and put a couple of marks that are further apart, and then you can get
it twice.
Yep. And it's you know, I've had to reject parts before where something will jump and you know, now I'm making a new leg and you know.
Okay, well that makes me feel better that I didn't recognize it was a domino.
Yeah.
You're double dominoing.
Yeah. Double dipping with the Domino XL for sure.
Tricky.
Yeah,
That's why I just assumed it was like one of those multi-routers or pan-router type situations. But yeah, that's pretty cool. That's an interesting solution. And yeah, once you get good at doing something like that, I imagine it's just like second nature, especially after all the chairs you've built so far.
I mean, I think I'm actually more and more looking at the pan-router and I'm looking at Shaper Origin and I've looked at slot mortisers like a million times on Craigslist, and I've never pulled the trigger because I kind of just like, well, I've done it this way, so
this works.
So looking at a few examples of your furniture on your website, the stools, and then up to what looks like a side table or a wall table or something, but like you tend toward a round leg, and then the stretchers between look like they started as like a half lap or otherwise splined maybe, but how are you forming all of those combinations after the fact? You can tell how it's kind of put together initially,
but then
it's really nicely blended
you know,
thereafter. Is that all power carved or what?
There's a little bit, like, I don't know if we're looking at the same stuff. Like, if you go, say, to my store and you pull up the, like, the Rivington Credenza, or there's some motifs going on there where I'm scrolling here. So like, the base on that Credenza.
Yeah.
I had this breakthrough. I mean, I'm sure other people are doing it, but for me, it felt, like, revolutionary. I was super into the idea of, say, like the sides of that base where you have these cylindrical parts, but they kind of sweep into another rail, like the horizontal rail.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was really into doing that. I just wasn't sure how to do it. And so I just kind of in my own mind tried to demystify it. And I just started thinking about, you know, a lot of the work I do is premised on the tooling I have. And so thinking, well, I've got a router table, you know, and I've got round over bits. And so if I do 1.5-inch thickness parts, and then I do 3/4-inch roundovers on all sides. Mm-hmm. Now I've got 1.5-inch round part. And then so the sweep part is accomplished, you know, in the next step, right? I glue it first. It's all cured and done. And then I do a pattern. So I do a lot of pattern work where I've got, you know, that shape with the angles figured out. I don't know what you guys call it. I call it a scoring pass, where I'll take like a 1/4-inch MDF template or pattern and then a trim router with like a mortise on it, and basically score the template into the real wood, the real parts. And then I take that over to the router table and flush trim it, you know, with like a compression bit.
Yeah, so you're using that as your reference for the bearing.
Yep, that's right. And then so now I've got still square parts. And then the final step is to take the proper roundover bit, because I also do, like, one of the stools I do is 1.25-inch. So I use a 5/8 roundover for that one.
Router, right.
And it's just really all it's doing is it's creating this the cylindrical shape where it looks like a turned part, but it's allowing you to get that sweeped look into the horizontal rail. And, you know, to me, I just think it's beautiful. Like, I'm very much attached to it. I don't know when I'll
No, it's a very cool look for sure.
So then, like, say still with that piece, when you've got the long part, the long rail connecting the two sides, that was another breakthrough for me too, where I knew I wanted to do like a lap joint, and I made my first round of stools some years ago, and I did the lap joint, and I had all these rails, and it was all glued up. And when I came down the next morning, you know, you pull the clamps off and the next morning looking at what you did, I thought the rails looked like way too chunky. They just looked off to me, like too big. And I was already committed, you know, I'd already glued it and I didn't really want to start over. And so the only solution I could think of was to shrink down the height of the rails. And that's where I do use the power carver. I do power carving to create that sort of sweep into the legs. So it's power carving, and I do some rasp stuff and just a bunch of sanding. You know, I kind of shoot myself in the foot. I have these ideas of what will look good, and I commit myself to all this sanding and, you know, trouble.
Right? Well, what about some of your upholstery work? Do you do that yourself? Is that in-house, or do you have a upholsterer that does that for you?
Yeah, so I do all the slip seats. So
okay.
And I would probably continue to do that because, you know, there's all these issues with people's lead times and, trying to work me into their rotation. So that was another one, another example of, you know, I made this chair and I knew it was going to have a slip seat, and I was just like, well, I guess I'm going to do upholstery. I do all that, but then like some of the other pieces, like there's the, Vaughn lounge chair there that has definite sewing going on, seamstress stuff, and, you know, beyond me. So I pay an upholsterer here in Portland to do that.
Okay, cool.
That stuff all just kind of drops in though, so you don't have to, they can start the, before you start the chair, right?
What's that? Could you?
They can start the upholstery before you start the chair if time is an issue.
Yeah.
Because it just sets in there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and actually some of them, it depends, you know, like I'm pretty big on, again, like say the Vaughn chair, the first iteration of that, there was no plywood on the seat cushion. It was just like all foam. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't super happy with how that laid into the chair. And so from then on, I started giving the upholsterer a plywood, 1/2-inch plywood kind of substrate, you know, to attach foam to. And it just sits better on the chair. But yeah, for sure, I or the upholsterer, whoever, could just start with a piece of plywood or just dimensions and go from there.
That's cool. Mm-hmm. Now, I really like this new chair. I think it's one of your newer chairs, the Talbot lounge chair.
Yeah. That's Kyle. This is how I feel like I know who you are, is because of your jig.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, yeah. So this is the one that you bought my jig for. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Sense. I had like notions of what
he
I
says
wanted.
Like you didn't actually know that, but anyway.
yeah, I'm trying to think how I found your jig. It was somehow on Instagram. I think it was from is his name Craig Silent Mill.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I haven't met Craig. You know, like you know people kind of sorted on Instagram.
Yeah. He was a good guy. Yeah.
He was hyping your jig a couple times, and I was aware of it, but I just didn't at the time have a need for it yet. And then so this chair was in my head, and that jig was so clutch for doing that in the back. But yeah, this is the newest design.
Well, I like that. That's really nice. So are you steam bending that, or is that bent lam on the arm bow?
So yeah, the seat rail is steam bent, and I actually have another shop make that part for me.
Okay.
Because it's a pain in the ass to make that. That's an inch and a quarter thick part, and there's there's a good amount of compression going on in there. And they actually told me, I asked for white oak because I've done walnut, I've ordered ash, and the shop that makes it for me said they refuse to do white oak for those dimensions because of the thickness. It's an inch and a quarter thick part. So that's the seat rail. But then the back crest, continuous backrest, is three parts. So,
Okay. So it's similar to like a Welsh stick chair then, three parts making up that arm bow, as I would call it.
Yeah, and I'm kind of going through, I'm actually still sorting out how I'm going to, what you see in those pictures is kind of like a, I guess it's not a finger joint. It's like, what is it called when you have like multiple tongue and grooves? It's not just one tongue and groove. It's like, I think it's two tongues and three, you know, what is that called?
Oh,
I don't know what it's called, but I know what you're, they use it in trim all the time, but it's much, the fingers are very small.
Well, like so
maybe a feather joint, a feather board that's been put together
finer than a finger
pair of feather boards.
So the coming, I have an order for two more of those, and I just got a shaper a few weeks ago. So that's a whole new world for me. And I'm going to, I bought a cutter that's a finger joint cutter. So that's my next step is, I always call it stitching it together. But the back crest is three parts, and the seam is kind of hard to see it from up there. But, it's the part where your back touches down, that starts out as like a 5.5-inch solid wood part. It's actually quite a bit of material that gets cut off to make that shape.
Imagine. Yeah.
It's like all 5.5-inch wide parts, inch and a half thick. And then they're mitered. It's a mitered joint. And then I've got a pattern. Once again, the pattern work where I flush it down to that. It's kind of like a horseshoe shape almost.
Yeah. Yeah. That is very interesting. Yeah. I like the design of that. It looks comfy too. That's the most important part.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Well, I don't know. Some of those arts and crafts people would argue with you, but anyway.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, well, speaking of that, so tell us a little bit about your shop. So I've seen a couple of pictures here and there of your shop, but it looks like you have some nice equipment in there.
Yeah. So I'm kind of actually just today, just coincidentally, I just pulled the trigger on a 20-inch Powermatic bandsaw. I'm super stoked on that.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it's a lot of coin, but you know, I'm
a big boy.
Yeah, I have a 17-inch Grizzly right now, which has served me well, but I'm looking for various things, more power for the motor, resawing, and you know, some of the calibration. It's like I'm not a big fan of like every time you go to a machine, you got to like tune it.
Right.
So I'm very hopeful that this new machine will be more reliable day in and day out for just the calibration and all that stuff. I've got mostly traditional machines. I've got jointer planer, drum sander, bandsaw, got a lathe. So a lot of the round stuff I'm doing, some stuff I am turning for sure. A lot of the legs and things like that. I got a lathe with a duplicator attachment. And I just got this summer a Minimax slider saw, which has been huge. I'm super happy with that.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that's been great. I've been yearning for one of those for a while. And then, you know, I've got lots of routers and a lot of repetition with the pieces I'm doing. There's a lot of router work, a lot of templating, a lot of work on the slider saw, you know, repeatable cuts and stuff like that. Band saw. I do a lot of my chair backs are just cold bends, like bent laminations, where I'll take a 6-quarter board and get, you know, 7 layers and glue it back together so it looks, you know, seamless and all that. But yeah, the shop is, there's nothing, no surprises in the shop.
Have you ever worked with that? You said cold bin. Have you ever worked with that? What is that cold bin wood that they sell that's already pre-compressed and everything, and you can just buy it and they ship it to you and you take it out of the plastic and you got like so long to put it into shape and then it'll dry and stay in that shape?
Oh, yeah. No, I have the
Lost Art Press blog.
Yeah, exactly. I forgot what that's called. I mean, it's not cheap, but yeah, they've already done some sort of compression to the wood and treated it, and you know, it's in a plastic form and you get it. And then I think you got like an hour or so to put it into whatever shape you want it to and clamp it in place, and it dries into that shape.
Oh, wow. That sounds like pressure.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of pressure. I think they actually squeeze the wood down with these.
Pure timber. Well, no, it used to be called pure timber. What's it called now? Cold bend hardwood.
Cold bend hardwood, yeah.
That's the product name. I guess that's that is also the company. So.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I haven't used that.
I was just thinking on that chair you were talking about, that company that said, hey, we want to do white oak, and that you might be able to buy this stuff in white oak.
Yeah, true. Yeah. I feel like, there's always the next thing to buy. Like, I still don't have a vacuum press. So some of these things that come my way, I will, you know, farm out to another shop. So there's a few things I'll have CNC'd, like the template for that Talbot chair, the backrest. Right. That pattern was CNC'd just on some like 3-quarter plywood. So, you know, occasionally if I need a vacuum press, I'll have to go somewhere else. It's one of those things where, you know, I don't know how it'd fit too much more stuff in my shop.
Well, it sounds like you got a nice shop and it keeps expanding. You said you just got a shaper in there too, huh?
Yeah, that's it. You know, I keep adding as much as I can. You know, I'm just kind of running out of space at this point.
Yeah, cool. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how quickly that can spill up.
Yeah, right.
Just got to try harder, you know. It's
Hey, well, you just got to add on to your shop. That's all
there you go. To it. Yeah, that's the easy solution.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is. Just what's,
you know, you're going to eventually want that 4x8 CNC back there, you know.
Yeah, man. My wife has asked me so many times. She's like, when are you going to get a CNC? And I'm just like, can't. I'd have to add on to a space that's only like 3 years old. You know?
Sorry, did you just say I could get one?
Really? Ah, sounds okay. Like a
Well, fantastic. Well, what's next for you? Anything that you want to promote or?
No, I can't say I have anything in particular to promote. I'm kind of, as I mentioned before, I'm just kind of in that mode of just trying to keep up with orders and keep lead times under control and make sure there's more stuff in the pipeline. And, you know, and I'm happy with that. I feel content with where things are at in that way, you know, just kind of going through this routine of, I'm always trying to get another design figured out. I mentioned doing a new table design and trying to sell what I have and think about the design after that. And, you know, I'm pretty happy in that mode. You know, that feels good to me. I've got a credenza on the way and I've got a set of stools and, you know, there's a nice backlog of stuff that's mine. I've been trying to avoid doing too much one-off pieces. I learned some hard lessons, you know, just not making any money and just in the weeds trying to figure out how to make something I'll never make again. So I'm on a good run right now. I'm just selling my pieces that I know how to make, and you know, when I'm able to introduce new designs, and that feels great to me.
Well, fantastic. Well, that is great. Well, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices.
You're here.
So I am drinking, what am I drinking? I'm drinking Austin East Ciders, Texas Honey Cider. I think I've recommended this before. It's a great cider if you can get it in your area. Again, the, I guess the cider, well, what did we decide they are? They're not a brewery. They're a cider maker.
Cideria in Spain.
Cideria.
Cideria. Yeah. Oh.
Okay. Well,
Spain,
anyway.
Spain, that's what they call them.
Well,
that sounds fancy.
Cider House.
Yeah, Cider House. Well, this one's Austin East Ciders. And again, that's Texas Honey Cider. And it's a real nice fall choice.
Nice.
Is it officially cider season now? Now that we've passed the equinox?
Anytime cider season down here. But anyway, I think so. I mean, it's only like 83 degrees here, so it wasn't too bad.
I think it was amazing. Warmer here today than it was there.
But it was raining all day today, so yeah, that's one
we'll
of the
get
reasons.
Well, that's a cool day. I get it.
Okay. Yeah. So Mark, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a Blue Moon again. I think it's the last one out of that 12-pack that I bought however long ago. So
that's all right. You got your little wedge of orange in there?
No, we didn't have any citrus in the house other than a lime for my wife's gin and tonics. But she spent a couple years in Africa in the Peace Corps and learned to love gin and tonic while she was over there. So
have you tried gin? This I don't know if you can get it in your area. It's called Esme. E-S-M-E.
E-S-M-E?
Yeah.
No, but I will look
I've
for
never
it.
Heard of that.
It's a French gin, and it is fabulous. We've been drinking it all summer, gin and tonics and other type stuff. I believe that's what it is. ESEM gin.
ESEM or ME?
ESME. Yeah, sorry. ESME.
ESME.
Yeah, SME.
Well, if gin. I can't get it, I'll send you some money and you can ship one.
And you can get some for me.
Yeah.
But it's relatively, I mean, gin's not an expensive alcohol to begin with, so it's right around the same price, but it's like $20 or so 20, but it is absolutely fantastic. It's our new favorite gin. A friend of ours used us to it. Yeah,
I picked up a bottle of gin from Dogfish Head when I was out there visiting Chris Keen, and it had an orange citrus sort of laid over it. They had a couple different flavored gins, and I brought two bottles home. That quickly became my wife's favorite gin, and then we couldn't get it anymore because I'm nowhere near Delaware. So and they don't sell it in our state. So if anybody out there is listening and wants to do a swap of some kind, let me know.
Hit Mark.
How many benches for how many
well, I was thinking like a bottle of whiskey.
How many,
a bottle
I said gin, that too, but, yeah, how many bottles for a bench? Yeah.
If only I could sell a bench, I would.
So anyway, well, great. So Sean, what are you drinking?
So I've got a coworker of mine is a chemical engineer and an avid beer maker on the side, so much that he's won some states in the some awards in the state of Ohio, and has had a couple breweries brew his recipes. Tonight, it's funny because every once in a while, he'll just like catch me as I'm walking through the office and go, hey. And this time he called me over to his desk, and he pulled out his bottom drawer, and he's got a six pack in there. He goes, here, this is for you. And awesome. so this was his Costa Rican stout, and so it's a stout with a little bit of chocolate, and then he said he put, I don't know how much he made, but some pounds of plantains in it.
It's
kind of like bananas and chocolate, you know, like that kind of thing. But it doesn't have the you don't get all the sweetness of the plant. Actually, I can't say that. I've never eaten a plantain. I know
they're not super sweet.
Yeah, they're not.
They're
sweet.
Like giant bananas.
They're more like starchy potatoes.
yeah.
flavor.
I mean, you can grill them and they get some, you know, they're good. But anyway, but he uses those, and it does have the sugars in it. And so he was telling me how it's like bottle conditioned and the sugars are creating the alcohol and yada, yada, yada. But it was very good, very smooth, not heavy at all. Very, very good. The guy knows his stuff. Unfortunately, there's zero distribution. It's only in my office that I can get it.
thanks for recommending limited, an easy to find beer, Sean.
Yeah, very easy to find.
Yes.
Less than regional.
Yeah.
Very much less.
And on another note, his leg is feeling much better.
yeah, sure. So, Kyle Kidwell, what are you drinking?
I am drinking, there's a brewery here in Portland called Lone Pine, and they make it's a double IPA. I don't know if you guys have been in that danger
zone. New England IPA.
Oh, yeah.
It's called OJ, which I don't think it's referencing like juice. It says like OH-J.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
It's super tasty. They make delicious beer, and I love it.
Yeah. Ooh, that's nice. That's nice. Yeah.
That's good stuff. Next time I'm on the East Coast, I'll look it up because I don't think I've heard of Lone Pine before.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even keep up with all the breweries around here. There's like there's a new one all the time, but there's a bunch of good ones. But that's, you know, I usually have some Lone Pine kind of something in the fridge.
Nice.
Well, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, that's nice.
Well, so Kyle, where can folks find you on the interwebs?
Yeah, so I'm on I'm at kidwellfabrications.com, and then that will lead you to my Instagram handle. There's like a little icon down there. I'm just Kidwell Fabrications on Instagram, and I have like a saying my YouTube channel bad. I've got just a handful of videos on there, but technically I have a YouTube channel going, and there's a few things to look at. But yeah, that's my big intro.
Yeah, you're on Vimeo too.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, so right, sorry. Yeah, that's not linked on my website though. I think the Vimeo is still Kidwell Fabrications. So yeah.
Well, yeah, I clicked on something on your website. I guess when you're about video,
it's got a video section. It did
the Vimeo, which you know, Vimeo's great, but I'm starting to really hate them. They got the worst interface in the world.
Yeah,
you know, Yeah. To go there and find out who you subscribe to, and you know, and God forbid if you purchased anything on them, which I've purchased some stuff. It's like every time I go there, I go, okay, I have to relearn your entire site just to find out what I bought, you know, and right. Get to it.
You know, the reason I'm on Vimeo is I wasn't trying to do that, but I did some work with this videography company called Lone Spruce. Yeah. And they did the two videos on my website. And when I was uploading them on YouTube, and I don't really know what I'm doing, the video quality was pretty grainy. It was like pixelated.
Yeah. And
they were just like, you got to put it on Vimeo. It's a better quality.
Yeah. That's what they have going for them. They got better quality video than YouTube does. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their interface is just horrendous. Anyway.
Yeah, so yeah, that's why I'm on Vimeo. That was just them basically saying, do you want better quality, then join Vimeo. So yeah. I followed the instructions.
Okay, well, that's my rant on Vimeo. So anyway, so Mark, sorry, I was dealing with them today because I was trying to figure out something that...
You're watching Pete Galbert's.
I have Pete Galbert's. I have been watching that, but I was like on my phone... Because I know that it's a sharpening technique that Chris Swartz did, and he has all his stuff on Vimeo. So I go, well, let me just go to Vimeo and get it. And it was like impossible to get logged in and find it. I finally just had to come upstairs, go to the computer, go to the blog, and then go from there. Because it was just so. Anyway, so that's my rant for the day on that. So Mark, where can folks find you?
You can find me at jointeffort.net and at Mark Builds It on Instagram. You can also check out videos on YouTube. I looked at Vimeo, but YouTube is a search engine, and that's how people find me. So, yep. If you're going to embed videos in your site, I think maybe Vimeo is a good way to go. But if you want to be found, go to YouTube.
Yeah.
Play to Live in Woodworking on YouTube. I don't. That channel may change names, but I'm not sure how that's going to work with back issues of this show. So if you don't find Play to Live in, take a look for Joint Effort on YouTube. So
fantastic. And you can always find me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram or Kyle Barton on YouTube. Sean, what about yourself?
You can find me most every social media at SeanW78. Look for me there.
Fantastic. And do we have any reviews this week?
We do. We've got a review from Jeff O. Branch. And I believe that is his Instagram handle.
Yes, that's his Instagram. And he's been a guest.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When I was absent, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think it was before your time. But
or I'll be very embarrassed, one or the other.
Yeah, one or the other.
He was commenting on our episode where we had Jeff Miller, and he said, it's a good podcast. Funny story, Jeff Miller taught at Alabama Woodworkers Guild a few years ago. When he got into town, some of us took him to a local barbecue place. The next day, we asked him if he liked the barbecue. He did, but he said their chairs were terrible. So if you have a restaurant and you want to cater to chair makers, get some comfortable chairs.
Yeah,
that's right.
And if you listen to
someone that can make some of those chairs for you.
If you listen to this podcast and you want us to keep making good podcasts, go and leave a comment either on Instagram or Apple on iTunes podcast. What is it, Apple Podcast now? And let us know what you think so we can read your comments on the show.
And that just about wraps it up for this show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. And while you're there, please leave us a review. You can follow us on Instagram at MWA_podcast. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go over to patreon.com/MWA podcast. But the best thing you can do is tell a friend. Word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.